Axel, the author of Elder Rage, and I'm your host for Coping with Caregiving. And now we are going to speak with Michael F. Martelli, and he's a PhD. He directs Rehabilitation Neuropsychology at Concussion Care Center of Virginia and Tree of Life. He has 16 years of experience with specialization in practical holistic assessment and treatment services in the rehabilitation of neurologic and chronic pain disorders. He also specializes in challenging healthcare situations and provides individual group, family, behavioral consultation, and behavioral medicine services. He's produced a habit retraining model and methodology for neurologic rehabilitation. He also serves as the commissioner for psychology for the Commission on Disability Examiner Certification, and he's the president of the Brain Injury Association of Virginia and High Hopes Incorporated. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing affordable housing and opportunities for persons with disabilities. Hi, wow, welcome. Hi, Dr. Martelli.
Hi, Jacqueline. How are you?
Just great. Now, where did you get the experience of, you know, working with caregivers like this?
It's sort of an occupational requirement. As a rehabilitation neuropsychologist, I spent the last 16 years working in a variety of settings. I've worked inpatient, outpatient, transitional, and supportive care services. I've worked with a variety of physical disabilities, and that's really my specialty. These days, traumatic brain injury, but in the past, stroke or cerebrovascular accident, spinal cord injury, Parkinson's, MS, cerebral palsy, amputations, severe disabling pain, dementia, cancer, and the whole variety of elderly infirmed.
Wow. My gosh, you've seen it all, huh?
A little bit. Yeah, and I've also worked with a variety of ages, from the very young to the very old, sisters, mothers, brothers, husbands, and so it's been a representative sample. When I look at the statistics, what I discover is what I've seen is pretty much what, you know, all the family caregiver statistics sort of represent.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 7 persons has a major disability that requires caretaking.
Mm-hmm.
Family Caregiver Association says 6 million persons provide full-time, meaning more than, probably a lot more than 40 hours a week, long-term care,
mm-hmm.
caretaking, probably 4 or 5 times that in, at least 5 times that in part-time caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them have been female, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
The majority are mothers and daughters. But again, depending on the impairment and the age, but we also have had I've seen a fair number of husbands as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where my experience comes from,
and wow.
And then a few eye openers too,
mm-hmm.
and they may be worth I guess mentioning.
Go ahead.
Okay. The first thing I noticed when I was learning how to try to assess and treat persons with significant disabilities and impairments was the profound effect it has on family members.
Mm-hmm.
At least a 50% divorce rate in the first year or two after traumatic brain injury for younger persons, and for almost any other disability too.
Mm-hmm.
Rate drops off, of course, as you get older, but that's sort of a magic number, 50%. That 50% is another magic number that seems to fit for the level of depression in caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
It skyrockets much higher than that for persons who were relatively isolated and didn't have much family support. In those cases, it's much higher, and in those cases, you start seeing the traumatic kinds of reactions that often include consideration and sometimes attempts at
suicide. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Mm.
But probably the biggest, the one that's probably shaken me the most and caused me in many ways to worry more about caretakers than sometimes the persons who are the caretakees, is the tendency to see a level of irritability, sometimes aggression that even involves physically striking out,
mm-hmm.
against sometimes saintly mothers and daughters,
mm-hmm.
who are selflessly and often at great strain trying to help someone go to the bathroom or walk or eat. And these were not bad people. These were people who are sometimes pillars in their community,
right.
who are acting like maniacs.
They would have never dreamed of crossing the line, and now they're finding
themselves.
Well, it happened to me. I've never even slapped anybody across the face in my life. I've never had a physical fist fight. You know, I walked away from in third grade. You know, I never had any. And my dad, you know, was just awful and was so, attacked me, choked me, threw me out of the house, called me every nasty name. Call me every nasty name you can imagine. I just went through all this. And, you know, I felt like I could have killed him. I loved my dad. I loved him, and I could have killed him. So think what's happening to people out there that didn't have such a great relationship, you know, and they're going through these challenges. Elder abuse is reaching epidemic proportions, and I'm going, yeah, I get it. I get it. I understand. It's because nobody educated me how to cope with these behaviors.
That's right.
And nobody told me the 10 early warning signs of dementia.
Right.
Nobody told me the right doctors, not the right medications, not adult daycare. All those things that I didn't know could have cost me my life, because I could be in jail right now for choking him.
That's right. That's right. And no one also prepared us as the people who are eventually going to be likely to become disabled, given that by age 50, one in four persons has a major disability that requires some level of caretaking.
Right.
We haven't been prepared for the eventuality that's going to hit most of us,
right,
which is we're suddenly going to become dependent.
Right.
And that's pretty scary.
Right. So talk about that. You know, what can cause a person to strike out at the caregiver who's helping them is because they're so darn frustrated with what's happening to them.
Exactly. Exactly. Probably, and there are many explanations, but at the heart of almost everything that I ever have to cope with, and that's what I essentially have to deal with persons who have the impairments, is a catastrophic reaction.
Yeah.
The catastrophic reaction is a universal response. It's more apparent in some persons and certain disabilities than others, but it's a universal response of terror and despair at losses. Defines in function.
Yeah.
You have to understand the catastrophic reaction to understand the person who had the injury and their responses, because it decompensates and degrades everything. Mm-hmm. And it's much bigger than their personality. And that's why, regardless of personality types, lots of people have those reactions.
And if they've been challenging all their lives, my dad always had a bad temper. This was nothing new at 85. So he always screamed and yelled and pounded that fist, you know.
Yeah.
So he used the same techniques he always did, but now it was over things where he was just so angry at everything.
And those were tiny little blemishes compared to what a person is facing when they lose, you know, for instance, their real independence, when they lose physical abilities, especially if there's some paralysis, cognitive abilities, especially memory, especially understanding, and that's whether it's verbal or nonverbal.
Yeah.
The number of people who suddenly can't read, I mean, language is both verbal and nonverbal.
Yes.
If you lose the ability to read a person's nonverbals, you aren't sure what they're really saying, because words are usually ambiguous.
That's right.
Get out of here can mean you better move now, or that's really funny, tell me some more.
Right.
And if you miss that, and that happens often, especially when the right hemisphere is involved, that causes tremendous breakdown in communication. The person can't say what they want. They get mad.
Yeah. Dad couldn't find the right word, and he'd get angry about that. And I was trying to help him and make change. And I cried every day, and I tried to use logic and reason. And I'm so angry now that I didn't know then what I know now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you're on this program.
Our society doesn't prepare us for it.
No,
I mean, this has been a real eye-opener. You know, we certainly have people with disabilities in my family, but I didn't begin to understand it like I did until I saw what happens when the person's life, their life plan for how they were going to be the breadwinner or the caretaker is suddenly uprooted.
Yes.
And now they can't trust their senses, their friends, the people they used to relate to, the activities, the way they used to cope with stress, the way they used to feel good about themselves are all gone. And self-esteem and loss of control may be the biggest stressors, and the reactions are just, I mean, depression itself.
Mm-hmm.
Depression is at least 50% of people who have any kind of significant impairment.
Mm-hmm.
At least 50%.
And
depression makes you not care.
That's right. And then the caregiver gets it. I mean, the caregiver burnout that happens, you know, and that developed in me. I mean, I was just a whole year with two of them to take care for.
Yeah.
And I just was like ready to jump off a bridge, and I was so depressed, and I couldn't get the help I needed. And oh my God! And I just
And what had been love can turn to hate, because you suddenly become symbol of their impairments and their dependence. So instead of helping, you actually force them to confront their catastrophic reaction. And most people, after their impairment, spend their life figuring out how to avoid being confronted with their deficits. And here you are, taking somebody to the bathroom or helping them walk, when in fact, all they're feeling is you're showing them how they can't do it themselves. And they get mad because why do you have to force them to realize what they can't do? And that's as irrational as a response that sounds like. It's pretty understandable emotionally.
Yeah, now I look back at it and I go, well, of course, Jacqueline, how could you have been anything but have this roller coaster of emotions? You know, I mean, I pat myself on the back and kiss myself in the head going, you're a good daughter. You didn't kill them, you know?
Yeah.
Now, talk about in your book and on your website, I've read, you know, that what are the rules and the caregiver survival rules? Let's make sure everybody gets those.
Okay. Well, they are on the website. And the good news is that even if, you know, even though we aren't going to have enough time to really talk about them, they sort of help with sort of the super duper coping strategies that are needed, because we didn't learn in home economics or shop class how to handle these stressors that most of us end up facing. And probably the most insightful experiences I've had were usually from people who gave little pieces that I had to complete. People often have pretty good insight. The caretaker survival roles, these are sort of the standard. I mean, you can get good resources from lots of different places, but the caregiver survival roles are sort of my distillation after a bunch of years of what seems to really hold, what seems to really explain what you have to do to cope in an almost unreasonably demanding situation like caretaking. I'll go through them real quickly, but they're
nuggets
on the website.
Okay.
So caretakers can't take care of anyone if they burn out from not taking care of themselves.
That's right.
You have to take care of yourself. This is, in fact, in the caretakee's best interest to make the caretaker take care of themselves. For starters, maybe try scheduling half a day off per week. Usually people have to do things in little increments because they can't take big steps. But they can do little ones. Half a day off for rest or relaxation or some form of relaxation that doesn't involve treating, helping, caretaking, or in any way providing a service and being responsible for someone else and in a situation where they can't do it themselves.
Right.
Industrial psychologists know that you don't schedule work for more than 40 hours a week. That's because productivity is so low, it's not worth paying a person any money past 40 hours. Well, caretaking, the average long-term caretaker spends 65. Yeah, 65 plus, and 65 is an underestimate.
Right.
So a lot of that is inefficient time. There's no time to restore.
And then you're up all night because they're up all night many times.
Yep.
And you just don't get any rest.
Absolutely. The other thing is, and this is number two, it's absolutely in both the patient and the caretaker's best interest to learn to easily and openly ask others for help. Especially with women who are sort of socialized to sacrifice and to, you know, caretake for children, that can get distorted and it can get perverted. That's only when children are very young that you're supposed to sacrifice like that. It's in the caretaker's and the caretakee's best interest to learn to ask for help and not be too proud. Often it's difficult getting help, so unless you're being fairly assertive and unless you're constantly creating the expression and asking for help, it's not gonna materialize. This is a big one too. Number three, at least some of the caretaker patient time or the caretaker caretakee time, especially when it's husband and wife, has to include some non-caretaking activities. That is, it has to have activities where that person can interact in an area of strength instead of weakness.
Right.
That is, an area where they can feel competent and have some self-esteem, especially for leisure activities. You know, a lot of people conceptualize life, and psychoanalytically they do, as love and work or love and work and play. Play is often something that people maintain some residual abilities in, and that's an important area to develop, especially when you can't work.
And there's brings me back to adult daycare, which I say every week on this program, because then they go, they have a whole life.
Absolutely, and not only that.
You get the respite.
Yeah, you get respite, and they get to see that they're not the only one.
Yes.
And this is a great myth. The myth is, you know, it's sold everywhere in television. The myth is that we're all going to be healthy forever.
Mm-hmm.
But one out of four at age 50 has a major disability. And if you look at the number with minor disabilities, it's even higher than that. So, you know, we think we've been gypped when, in fact, the statistics say, you know, especially if you look at the number of people who have died or had a disability by age 50, it's not all that unusual to have a disability by age 50.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not.
No.
And when you see other people, that normalizes it, and then you don't feel so...
Right. And plus, they keep you so busy there. They have activities from the minute you walk in and all the socialization and crafts.
Absolutely.
That they forget,
absolutely.
About, they forget about the daughter that they've been harping on all morning, and they have a whole day of
absolutely.
Of fun.
And, you know, some of those other people, other persons in the program see their daughter and think their daughter is great. That makes them...
Yes.
Remember what it is about their daughter that's great.
That's right.
And just a little bit of help somewhere can go a long way.
Thanks, Dr. Martelli.
You bet. Go to the website. They're all there.
All righty.
Help us lead the way.
Tell a friend.
We are WS Radio.
WSRadio.WS.
The worldwide leader in Internet talk.